Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the problem of for-profit colleges. Interest in for-profit colleges comes in waves, and we're currently in one of those moments. The pandemic, the move to online learning, and the economic recession had led many to these higher ed institutions. Add to that a Trump administration that loosened regulations of these schools, and the industry is once again growing. For-profit colleges have a long history of fraudulent practices, and their students tend to leave with exceptionally high levels of debt. My guest today, David Whitman, explores why it's been so hard to regulate them in his new book titled The Profits of Failure, For-Profit Colleges and the Closing of the Conservative Mind. We spoke Tuesday morning. David, I think many Americans don't know very much about for-profit colleges. Explain what a for-profit college is and just how big the industry actually is.
Well, the industry is surprisingly large, and as you say, it's very little known. People don't think of for-profit colleges when they think of where they want to send their own children to college. They think of a research university at in their state or their alma mater, maybe, but they're not thinking of for-profit schools like the schools that you sometimes see advertised on television. University of Phoenix, Strayer University, Capella University, and then all of the sort of trade schools that trade cosmetologists, registered nurses, HVAC technicians, and those kind of professions. So John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, once said that for-profit colleges are second-class citizens in higher education, and I think that's true. I think it's very unfortunate because these schools educate a lot of students. When the Obama administration came to office, there were about 2 million students in for-profit colleges. Today, there are about 1.2 million. And these students tend to be the students that are the most neglected and the most vulnerable students in the country.
What do you mean by neglected and most vulnerable?
Well, more than half of the students are minority students are Black or Latino. They are often single mothers raising children who are trying to better themselves. They're non-traditional students. They're displaced workers who have lost their jobs and want to go back and get retrained for a new job. They're veterans often. There are 160,000 veterans who were in for-profit schools in 2017. So these are a lot of the students who you don't think of as the traditional sort of undergraduate or graduate students.
So it sounds as though these schools serve lots of needy people. So what's wrong with them? Do they get a bad rap?
Well, I don't think they get a bad rap, but it's true that there are good for-profit schools out there and that they're fulfilling an important mission in training these non-traditional and disadvantaged students. Unfortunately, there's a disproportionate number of schools that are doing a poor job, and they are leaving these students sometimes worse off than they were before they went to the schools.
How come?
Well, they're leaving them with unaffordable debt. These students are going to for-profit schools to get training to get new and better jobs. And too often what they're ending up with is debt that they can't pay off from the jobs that they're being trained for. And sometimes they can't afford the whole program and they end up dropping out. And so they're worse off than they were before.
Well, now, is that any different from a regular nonprofit college? I mean, some students go to nonprofit schools, can't afford to continue, or decide that they're not doing well and they drop out. Isn't that the same thing that happens there?
It's a big difference in degree. So for most students, and the problem of student debt is really not well understood by a lot of Americans, most students who go to college take out federal student loans to attend, eventually pay off those loans. Now, it's not a nice thing to ever have student loan debt and have to pay it off over a period of years. But for most students, it's a good deal in the end. They end up getting a good job. They can pay off those loans from the job that they get. It's different at for-profit schools because what happens to a much higher degree is that the students, even if they complete their programs and get jobs in their field of training, cannot make enough money from the job they were trained for to ever pay off their loan. And so it's the problem of unaffordable debt, not just the problem of debt per se, that is so onerous and so painful for people.
How different then is the debt? How many students default on their loans at for-profit schools rather than at nonprofit colleges?
Well, let me mention one other point here. Community colleges also run a lot of these career training programs. You can get trained to become a massage therapist at a community college, and you can be trained to be one at a for-profit school. When the Obama administration implemented a rule that said, basically, it's called the gainful employment rule. And when it implemented this rule that said, you have to make enough money from the job you're trained for to pay off your federal student loan. And they had a measure of what was affordable debt and what was unaffordable, kind of like applying for a home mortgage loan or something like that. Do you qualify? Do you not qualify?
Right.
So 98% of the programs that failed that gainful employment test were at for-profit colleges. Only about 1% of the programs that failed were at community colleges. So the problem of unaffordable debt is really concentrated at for-profit colleges. And it's a stunningly large problem. In 2018, more than 12 million Americans had racked up outstanding federal loan debt of $251 billion at for-profit colleges. So, and if you look at it in terms of percentages, more than half of students who enroll in a for-profit college with a federal student loan default within 12 years. And 75% of Black students who borrow and drop out of their for-profit school default within 12 years. And when you default, that's so many serious consequences.
So who pays off those loans? How do these schools continue to operate if the loans aren't paid off?
The taxpayer gets stuck with the bill. The for-profit schools never have to pay the bill for those loans. The students apply to go to the school. They go out and get a federal student loan. The federal student loan money starts coming into the school. And then the student isn't responsible for paying the loan off until their education is completed, until they're out of the school. Meanwhile, the for-profit school is just sifting more and more new students through, getting more and more new loans.
So it's the taxpayer who is stuck with the bill eventually because these students are taking out these federally backed loans. And when they can't pay them, does the federal government then reimburse the for-profit school?
No, I don't think they reimburse the for-profit school, but they will pay off the student loan. The for-profit school already got the money.
Right up front.
Right. But they'll impose they'll impose penalties on those students. So if you default, you can't. It makes it hard to ever get a mortgage. It makes it hard to take a loan out to buy a car. People have to defer getting married. You know, it's a very painful experience. When the for-profit Harrison College in Indianapolis closed abruptly midterm in 2018, one of the students who was left in the lurch was a woman named Holly Dumas, who was a 43-year-old woman who was pursuing a nursing degree, even as she cared for her elderly mother and a disabled husband with a traumatic brain injury. And she told the Chronicle of Higher Education, "Every day I get on Facebook and I hope and I pray that someone I go to school with hasn't killed themselves, because that's how devastating this has been for all of us.
David, how long have these for-profit schools been around, and has this problem been, as you describe, right from the beginning?
The for-profit schools didn't get federal money until the World War II GI Bill. And everybody thinks of the World War II GI Bill as landmark legislation. It's been called the greatest legislation. And in many respects, it was an extraordinary, important, and profound piece of social legislation. But the one thing that people have forgotten about the GI Bill is that it led to a huge spate of abuses of just the kind that we've seen today in for-profit schools. There were thousands of for-profit schools that opened up to get those GI Bill benefits, educational benefits, with these new GIs who were newly eligible with federal support to go to college. In fact, more people signed up for for-profit, more GIs signed up for for-profit trade schools than signed up to go to four-year universities and colleges. But in answer to your question generally, Diane, this whole cycle of abuse and regulation and it's kind of been a boom-bust scandal cycle, and that has gone on and on repeatedly, at least four or five times since World War II.
You're saying that with each administration that's come in, there's been some change in the rules that either put down the for-profit schools, and then a new administration comes in and they come back again.
Yes, and the critical factor is federal money. Is easy federal money available to these for-profit schools or not? And there's been a dozen occasions since World War II where the federal government loosened the purse strings on federal support for for-profit schools. And each time there were new scandals, new abuses, new regulation in Congress, new hearings in Congress, new reports from GAO, then Congress said, or the administration acted, they restricted access to the for-profit schools. And then a few years passed and everybody said, the problem's not so bad. What are we worried about? And they loosened the purse strings on federal money and the whole cycle starts all over again.
So take us through the Bush, Obama, Trump administrations. What happened during those three?
So the first Bush, George H.W. Bush administration, was one of the toughest administrations in terms of cracking down on for-profit schools and abuses in the sector. And that really followed upon Ronald Reagan's second Secretary of Education, William Bennett, who was a scathing critic of for-profit trade schools. And now today, Republicans are identified with strong support for for-profit schools, and the Democrats are the critics of for-profit schools. But back in 1988, it was Ted Kennedy who was defending for-profit schools and Bill Bennett who was criticizing them. In terms of the second George W. Bush administrations, they, again, that flip-flop between the Republicans and Democrats had happened. And the George W. Bush administration was very sympathetic to for-profit schools. They loosened regulations. There was a huge outbreak of abuses and scandals. The Obama administration cracked down on for-profit schools, and the Trump administration then came in and undid everything that the Obama administration did and completely threw open the doors to a new round of abuses.
So that must have expanded then the applications that came in to these for-profit schools.
Well, it didn't initially, because there was still a sort of aftermath of the Obama administration, and the economy was strong. So it's when the economy is strong, fewer people are going back to school to get retrained or to get a new occupation. So the issue, though, is that people are watching very carefully is, what about that coronavirus aid to higher education? Is that going to create a new round of abuses with students who are suddenly out of work, out of jobs, feel like they can't compete in the job market right now and want to go back to school. So that's something to watch. The community college sector really shrank during the pandemic. And the for-profit sector is the only sector that grew during the
pandemic. That grew? And yeah. Why was that?
Well, partly it was because of what I mentioned, that when the economy's terrible, people go back to look for retraining. But part of it, I think, may have been that there was also very lax regulation of the for-profit sector in the Trump administration.
And you could do it all online?
A lot of it is online, yeah. And a lot of the for-profit sector, particularly the bigger for-profit chains, are all online now.
You yourself actually went to a for-profit school.
That's correct.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I was a journalist for many years. I wrote for U.S. News and World Report. And part of a mid-career transition out of print journalism, I decided I wanted to explore massage therapy. So I went to a for-profit massage therapy school in Virginia. I had a good experience there. I had very dedicated instructors. It was very convenient. I had a very unusual schedule where I took the summers off and worked as a writer out in Idaho, and they accommodated that schedule. They said, you can come back after you come back from Idaho and continue your courses and training. They had lots of parking convenient. They had volunteers who would come in to get massages, and they had a clinic where you could get your practice hours in. So it was a very good experience. And that's what, frankly, in my view, a good for-profit school should be. It should be a good experience. You should get training. You should get training in my case, I was able to go on and practice at a local spa.
So you did use your learning experience and work at what you had been trained. What about the payments, therefore?
So it wasn't cheap, but in my view, I wanted to go to a school that had a lot of older adults in it who were more clear about having a serious intent to explore massage therapy. So at a community college program, I wasn't sure if that was going to be the case. I thought I might get a bunch of 18, 19-year-olds who weren't really sure what they wanted to do, who were exploring various options. And that was, in fact, the case in my for-profit program. And I had to, I had to sit for the national certification test. I had to get my license in D.C. So there are formal benchmarks you have to pass to take advantage of that for-profit training.
So from where you sit and the research you've done, what kinds of promises do these schools make to potential students?
Well, this is one of the big problems of for-profit schools, because they overpromise. They often, not always, but they often overpromise and underdeliver. And there's a real imbalance between the students who are applying and the schools themselves. So they have often run misleading advertisement, for example, about their job placement rates. And there's really no way to check this. Sometimes they'll use figures that are not really their students, but they'll use the regional Bureau of Labor Statistics figures on how much students earn in a given profession or how many students are placed. And so they end up really often wildly exaggerating their success rates.
But is there no government regulation to check out these claims to verify before a student applies that what this organization is claiming is actually true?
There is some government regulation, and there have been some cases, for example, brought by the Federal Trade Commission, which brought one against DeVry University for overstating its job placement rates and the earnings of its graduates. But by and large, this has been very lax. People have said, well, what's a job placement rate? How do you define it? If you'd work for a day, is that a job placement? If you work for a week, is that a job placement? If you work at a intern training fair, is that a job placement? So there's been all kinds of loopholes that have allowed these schools to get away with misleading students.
More of my conversation with David Whitman when we come back. Here's the rest of my conversation with David Whitman. He is author of The Prophets of Failure, For-Profit Colleges, and the Closing of the Conservative Mind. He was chief speechwriter for former Education Secretary Arne Duncan from 2009 through 2014. In your book, you specifically highlight the recruiting practices of these for-profit schools. Tell me about how they go about getting their students in.
The inherent temptation, the inherent potential problem for for-profit schools is that they want to market, they want to spend the money that they're getting on marketing to recruit more and more students and spend less of that money on instruction and teaching students. So the more students you get, the more money, the more revenues you get at that school. And that creates this temptation to just market yourselves like heck and spend all kinds of money on recruiting practices. And so there's a lot of problems in the for-profit sector over a period of many decades, real boiler room, high pressure sales tactics, repeatedly calling students on the phone, you know, 5-6 times a day to try to get them to sign up, misleading job placement promises. And there's a lot of this that has happened. It's been very well documented. There are schools that engage in what's called pain recruiting, which is where it sounds counterintuitive, but you sort of demean the potential applicant. You say, well, you're not reaching your goals in life. You want to keep basically being a failure, or do you want to go to school and better yourself? And so there's all kinds of things like this that have a long history. And one of the schools that indulged in this was Trump University.
Trump University,
yeah. Made a lot of use of these abusive recruiting tactics. And Trump University was never really a university, and so it never qualified for any kind of federal aid, but it did engage in these and use these same kinds of predatory recruiting tactics.
In the book, you talk about something you call greyhound therapy. What is that?
Well, this is one of the most outrageous examples of abuses that occurred in the 1989-1991 timeframe. There was a school, a masonry institute in Houston that was trying to get more students. And what they did was they started recruiting the homeless. And there's a long history of recruiting individuals at homeless shelters, halfway houses for institutionalized mental patients, jails, drug rehab centers, welfare offices that cater to seasonal migratory farm workers. But the greyhound therapy was sort of first reported by the Houston Chronicle. And so two local for-profit schools were busing the homeless from shelters in Dallas and San Antonio and New Orleans to Houston to sign them up for student aid. And while they were on the bus, the homeless men and women signed their student loan promissory notes. When they got to Houston, the schools dumped the homeless back into the shelters and cheap hotels until the schools received their loan money.
How in the world did they get away with that, and for how long?
They got away with it for several years, and then there was hearings held by Senator Sam Nunn, who was chairman of the Subcommittee on Permanent Investigations, and between the Houston Chronicle coverage and these hearings by Sam Nunn, it really ripped the cover off this and halted it. But that pattern of recruiting people who don't really belong in college, who are really not ready for it, are not ready to succeed in it, that's a very, very common pattern in the for-profit sector. And it's particularly common now in recent years at big publicly traded for-profit chains of schools. These are for-profit companies that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And the stock market, because they're publicly traded, the stock market wants to know, are you growing? Are you getting more students? Are you getting more students? And so what they did was they started taking in students who were clearly not ready for a college course and just getting their federal loan money in, and then the students would drop out, you know, deep in debt.
I want to go back to this Greyhound therapy. All that the for-profit schools needed was a signature then on an application, which then the for-profit school took, filled out with all the information needed, handed in to the federal government. Federal government provides the money purportedly to that student, but rather it's going directly to the school. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right.
So then the poor individual who may have been homeless to begin with finds out later in life that he or she is saddled with loan payments that he or she never signed up for.
They didn't know they were signing
they
up for. That's exactly right. They're saddled with debt that they'll never be able to repay. Their credit is ruined. They default on their loans. And it's a tragic thing for people.
Were you able to talk with some of the people who had been hijinxed by these for-profit schools?
I was. And it's hard to convey the sort of daily burden of that kind of debt. And you have to remember that these students, in most cases, were trying to do the right thing. They were trying to go back to school to better themselves and to better the lives of their children and their family. And to end up with kind of worthless training for a worthless degree and lots of debt and defaulting on your debt. You know, you don't have to have $100,000 in debt. If you're a single mom with two or three children and you have $12,000 of debt that you can't pay, and that you have no realistic prospect of paying. Think of the burden of that, not just over a period of years, but every week, every month, every day that you know that this life crippling debt is looming over your head.
You went to a school which you found totally satisfactory. You did indeed find subsequent work in the field that you were trained for. Can you give me an estimate of how many of these for-profit schools are legitimate in their efforts to really educate the population and what percentage are not? I mean, I don't know whether you're saying we should totally eliminate for-profit schools, or whether there are simply some that ought to be shut down.
I'm definitely not saying we should just eliminate for-profit schools. I think that there is a need for the kind of training that they provide, and there's a need for the kind of ease and access that it can provide for mid-career people, for displaced workers, for all of those neglected students, non-traditional students that we're talking about. It's interesting, Diana. I think very few of these schools ever start out with bad intentions. I think it's very rare that you find a school that's really just run by a huckster, a shyster. And what happens instead is most of these schools, I believe, are set up with good intentions, but the incentive structure is to cut corners in providing a quality education. The incentive is to get more students in, spend more money on marketing, cut back on spending for instruction, take students who aren't really qualified because it means more money. And so it's a very subtle kind of system of perverse incentives to do the wrong thing. And I don't think it starts with a corrupt intent or an abusive intent.
So what would you like to see the Biden administration do to at least tighten the rules so that these kinds of egregious practices no longer can continue, and that the U.S. taxpayer is not left with the burden of all these debts.
Well, I think there are important, very important consumer protections that can be implemented by regulation and by law. And I think the first thing that the administration, and they promised that they're going to do this, is reinstitute two regulations that the Trump administration eliminated. One was this gainful employment rule that we referred to earlier, which basically says if you go to a career training program, you should be able to make enough from the job you were trained for to pay off your education. The Trump administration eliminated that rule entirely. So you can now get aid to go to a for-profit school that has zero graduates, zero people placed in jobs, and lots of people in debt. And that shouldn't be. There should be those consumer safeguards. The other rule is called the Borrower Defense Rule. And the Borrower Defense Rule ensured that students who had been defrauded by their schools, whether they're for-profit or not, but schools that had defrauded students by misleading them about their employment prospects, for example, if they went to the school. Those schools, the students who had been officially defrauded under state law, were entitled to get their loans forgiven. And the Trump administration didn't completely eliminate that rule, but they eviscerated it to such a degree that virtually nobody who had students who had been defrauded were getting their loans forgiven.
So on the one hand, you've got Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown sponsoring the Students Nonprofit Act, proposing to remove the entire sector of for-profit schools from eligibility for federal funds. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I understand why they proposed it, because of this history of the cycle of scandal and abuses that I've talked about. I don't think it's the right road to go down. I think the better road is to really do a much better job of regulating the sector to protect consumers.
And on the other hand, there is a push by the Biden administration to simply end student debt. I wonder if for-profit schools would actually benefit from a ruling of that kind.
Well, the Biden administration is talking about forgiving debt, I think, up to $10,000. And that would benefit certainly some students at for-profit schools, who, as I say, are less likely to have those kind of eye-popping $120,000 debt, $150,000 debt that you read about in newspaper stories. But it's not going to make the student debt problem go away. There's still a lot of students who own student debt under the Biden, what Joe Biden talked about during the campaign.
It might even provide an incentive for-profit schools to continue to do exactly what they've been doing. David, how can potential students know the difference between a school that really is going to deliver and those that are scam artists?
So it's a great question, Diane. There is something called the College Scorecard website. It's a government website, and it provides data that, and to the credit of the Trump administration, they added more data to it that does allow a student to go in and look at the first couple of years of data on student earnings from programs, student debt in programs. There's a lot of other data on that website. The problem is that you need to know where to go find it. You need to know it's called the College Scorecard, and you need to look at it. And I don't think in the end that you can completely put it on students to figure this out, what the good programs are and the bad programs are. I think we need to have minimal performance standards that these career training schools have to meet. So it's a combination of sort of doing your research, looking at the data on the College Scorecard, but also being wary of these kind of high-pressure sales tactics. They're usually a clue that something's wrong, that something is not fully there.
Forgive me for saying this, but in this day and age, even not-for-profit schools and colleges are having difficulty placing students in jobs, or students are having a tough time finding jobs after graduating from traditional four-year colleges and universities. I mean, the problem is really widespread.
That's true, Diana. It's obviously particularly true in the pandemic. But let's remember that these schools, for-profit schools, and some of these community college programs I mentioned, their mission, their job, is to train people for jobs. That's not true of four-year universities and colleges and universities. It's not true of Christian colleges. Even if you go to a research university, you won't get training to become a welder. You won't get training to become a HVAC technician. You won't get training to become a cosmetologist. So these schools are required under law to provide a program to prepare students for gainful employment in a recognized occupation. That whole job training mission doesn't exist in regular nonprofit four-year colleges and universities. Those schools are also trying to train students to become civically active, engaged in democracy. And the thought is that the training that they will receive, the education they will receive, will help qualify them for jobs down the road. Now, you know, I was a political science major. I didn't end up, you know, becoming a political scientist. I didn't end up, you know, think of sociology majors or, you know, I mean, you can go on and on and on. Those aren't majors that are training for specific jobs, but in the long run, you hope that the education you learned about how to write, how to think, are going to be valuable when you go out into the world.
Well, David, I want to thank you for being with us and congratulate you on this book, which I know took you a long time to write and is filled with information on the history of these schools, the regulations that have affected them both positively and negatively. And it's a cautionary tale for students to be very, very aware of as they look for training, especially in these days of the pandemic. So congratulations and thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
That was David Whitman. He is the author of The Prophets of Failure, For-Profit Colleges, and the Closing of the Conservative Mind. He was chief speechwriter for former Education Secretary Arne Duncan from 2009 through 2014. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Sandra Baker, and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.